We are Jazz and Justice, and because of your support, we are WPFW.
Yo, peace, this is Rod Stars.
Peace, this is G1, and together we're Rebel D.I.s. When we in the DMV, you know we listening to that People Power Radio, WPFW, Washington, your station for Jazz and Justice. Let's go.
I got so much trouble on my mind. Refuse to lose. Here's your ticket.
He is amazing.
I didn't know nothing about it.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Say what you say, say what?
I don't want to be like Mike.
Before Magic's knees go permanently south for the winter.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Changing up the guard quicker than fear brings down doo-doo.
With the finger roll, plus the foul.
Hey, young bro.
He never saw Elgin Baylor play during his day or Oscar Robinson.
Flash the dice roll back. The big O was jackknifing through all them bodies.
I didn't know nothing about it.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Collision. This is the part where I say he is Chuck Modiano. I'm Dave Zirin here at your home for Jazz and Justice, 89.3 FM WPFW, trying to change this world one broadcast at a time. And we all know it needs changing. We all know it's only going to happen through the powers of resistance, through the powers of visible dissent, and through the powers of non-compliance. We have so much to talk to you about this week. We got my favorite time of year coming up, 40 games and 40 nights, the NBA playoffs. This is my apex of sports escape, but of course, in the society we are in, there really is no escape. We have to confront what's right in front of our face, the grave threats we see. There's nobody I'd rather break each sides of that coin down with than the one and only Chuck Modiano. Chuck, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. How about yourself?
Well, first and foremost, Chuck, before we get to all things, not just playoffs related, but the way Steve Kerr has injected some politics into these playoffs, finally, when did you go to sleep last night, Chuck?
It had to be after 4 a.m. It was close to 5 a.m. I got home late, and I wasn't drinking either.
No. I think where you were is very important because we got to talk about that before we talk NBA, because I woke up this morning to a flurry of emails from people from around the country asking me what happened at Howard last night.
Yeah.
And that would be Howard University, just off Georgia Avenue, just off Eckington Place, historic Howard University. What did happen at Howard, Chuck, and were the police involved?
Well, there was an encampment that was launched at Howard, and the answer to your second question is yes. So let me be a little bit more specific than that.
Yeah, let's be specific about what this encampment is. What are its politics? How many people were there? Who is it for? Set us a scene, Chuck.
Okay, I'm going to set you a scene. And then I might even set a little bit of background after setting the scene.
Please, please.
So I get a little bit of a note. And around 5 p.m., Howard University students are launching an encampment. And it is it's in the yard, but it's sort of pushed in a portion of the yard that's not even in the middle of the yard. And then they set up a few tents, a big tent and a couple of other small tents. And it was very quiet. It was very quiet. There wasn't a big announcement. I got to interview a number of people. There is a, I would call it a manifesto online of what it's about, but it wasn't didn't have the clarity necessarily that the encampments at GW had, which Howard was one of the 9 universities. People forget that the GW encampments were 9 universities in solidarity, all asking to disclose and divest from their own university about Palestine. And while certainly this was about Palestine, it wasn't only about Palestine. So, you know, you heard chants, there was a Palestinian flag there. There was a rainbow flag there, both on top of the tents. But this was a little bit more encompassing. And they said, so I'm going to give you just a couple of items. They said they wanted to create an alternative education at Howard at this important time. Yes, we are going to continue to be in solidarity with Palestine, but we're also nervous about some of the ICE raids that have been going on, and we don't want that to happen at our university either. We are also concerned about the related DEI and things happening around the country. We don't want our Africana studies going away, Africana studies program going away. We're an HBCU, and we know our president has had some discussions with the Trump administration, but know nothing else about that. So these are discussions that they're not sure about. In some ways, it's a preemptive strike. The point was also made that we're going to have an encampment and protest with joy. So at 10:30 p.m., the Cupid Shuffle is going to break out. And that saying joy is resistance, that there's beauty in struggle. And we want to make sure, you know, we have that when we struggle. So throughout the night, you heard a bunch of different chants. It wasn't just free Palestine. It was free Congo. It was free Sudan. It was free all Black people in America. These were the different chants that you heard along the way. And so it didn't have like these 3 demands or anything like that. However, it was in many ways, in my view, sort of a preemptive strike before things might happen at Howard. We know there was a Georgetown professor, Dr. Bador Kansouri, something happened to him. So in many ways, they just said, we want to create the People's University. They called it the People's University, and 35 students were there and had a town hall after 6 p.m. And I got to witness that town hall and all that happened. And it was very positive. I mean, it was so positive. It was so much love. It was so loving until the police showed up. I mean, really until the police showed up. And then the police showed up and wouldn't leave. So their presence is really felt very early on.
A little bit of background. Where on the campus were they? And is that a historic place where people have been able to gather without the presence of police or police repression?
You know, first of all, it's a great question. And I wish I could give you the specific part of the yard that they were in. But your question is kind of a trick question, because, you know, Howard, like any other university, has had to been able to have, you know, tents or be out there. And a lot of things have changed, obviously, in the last year. So if you're asking me, because I can't give you the specific answer, because we know Howard has a long history of student uprising. And I can just go back the last couple of years. Yet not only were they part of the GW, but they had many events, many protests on their campus. If you go back a little bit further to the Blackburn takeover, 2021, is that? The Blackburn takeover, they protested in an encampment the housing conditions at that time, and were in tents for over a month there. It did get cold in November, which is different than April. And then there were protests of adjunct faculty in 2022, I believe, which was followed the Blackburn encampment by students. And in that adjunct faculty protest, because the protesters were making nothing, that was actually successful. Both at Howard and other universities like American, where the adjunct faculty were paid more. And in many ways, the success and the New Deal that came from the adjunct faculty protest in 2022 is really should be credited to the students in late 2021, because Howard did not want to go through one more bad news cycle at that time. And I just gave you the recent history. That doesn't talk about 1989 protests, 1968 protests. You can go back decades earlier. And some of this, or the reason I know this, is during the Blackburn takeover, the 1989 folks showed up in support with the students. So Howard has a very long history of protests as to, you know, that particular patch of land where they, the police, have moved in. Earlier, the way they did yesterday, the way they descended on a very small group at, it really concluded 3:30 in the morning. No, I don't think they would have. But, you know, if you want to talk to anyone, you want to talk to a guy named Dr. Joshua Myers, who wrote a book, who's a professor at Howard, and wrote a book about we're the ones we're fighting for, we're worth fighting for. And in discussions I had with students, they were saying, we want to invite professors in this space to do teach-ins. We want political education at our school. And they were going to look to invite him and other professors. Yeah, people know Dr. Carr is somebody who is a great historian and has showed solidarity with student protesters before. So So it was very much about really let's have political education. So one person who was speaking, and I covered their interview, they were saying Kwame Ture, Amiri Baraka, Zora Neale Hurston, these are powerful people who came out of Howard University. And I'm giving you a direct quote, but this institution hates radical Black people.
Oh, you're floating in and out, Chuck.
Okay. Do you hear me now? Okay.
Yeah, loud
what about
and clear.
Now? You got, how about now? Am I good now?
Much better. Much okay. better.
So much better.
Let's do it. Keep it
so
going,
I'm gonna
buddy.
Just give you this quote.
Wait, before you go on. Before you go on. Yeah, go on. Okay. I'm just still a little confused on one thing.
That's because I'm people... all over the place. But go ahead.
No. You were asleep. You woke up at 4 a.m.,
yeah,
buddy.
I'm a little groggy, bro. Yeah.
You went to sleep at 4 a.m. You're doing yeoman's work reporting this to us. So we got to get down the facts for our audience real quick. How many people were out at the encampment? How many tents? And was it all students? Answer those three, please.
About 6 p.m. or 6:30 p.m. when they were having a town hall, I counted 35 people. Okay.
Gotcha.
And,
gotcha.
And at that moment, they're all Howard students.
Gotcha.
However,
gotcha.
Not all the Howard students were in the tents. And some Howard students were admittedly nervous because there was a police presence almost immediately. People, there were people from Howard who were coming in, as they said, playing good cop. They're going to arrest you after 9 p.m. So that was the town hall and the activities. Then there were there was one big tent and maybe two small tents at the time, which, you know, it could have been more at night. And certainly would have been more at night, but that's where it started. And that 35 number is lower, you know, that 35, I don't know the exact number, but let's just say 10. Let me guess 10 young people were committed, and maybe many more, depending on how things went. Here's what happened. The police say at 9 p.m., you know, you're going to be arrested via someone from Howard. And then,
right,
you know,
so they were told it. Not, and just to be clear, too, it was it entirely focused on global to local oppression of people of color? Was it anti-U.S. imperialism abroad and anti-PIC prison industrial complex at home? Was it more Palestine than anything else?
Well, I
what
think
would
the,
you
your
describe
part,
as the animated imperial, politics.
Well, Palestine is part of it, but when you and yes, against U.S. imperialism, but you didn't just hear free Palestine. You heard a lot of free Palestine, no question. There were chants free Palestine. There's a Palestinian flag on the tent, but there was also free Sudan. There was also free Congo, also free Cuba. There's a very and I missed a number of countries. So the imperialist lens. Was very well. There was free Africa, and after you hear that, then it was free Black people in the United States. So the connections were made from abroad to home, and there was talk about, you know, the Africana Studies Department, and we don't want ICE here either, like we've seen at other universities, because there was a feeling that the leadership at Howard is maybe perhaps being too compliant with ICE. So. The answer to is really almost all of the above. It, like I said, it wasn't like these very three specific asks, because I asked that question. And there is a manifesto online that speaks to some of what that I'm talking about, and they called it the People's University. But to take you through the progression, because and it's hard to give you a easy answer because it changes during the night. So it goes from about 35 people in this town hall. There is almost immediately if that during that town hall, you have campus police, as a protester said, playing good cop and saying, okay, police are going to come. You need to be disbanded by 9. They weren't hearing that. People weren't leaving. And then after 12, there's a bigger round of that, and then you see police loading up on the street, vans down the block, cars down the block, MPD down the block, campus police, MPD, and you see them loading up. So what happens around midnight and is a call for other people to come down. The Howard students said, we want help. They don't have to be a Howard student. Come down. People are putting out calls to folks, and you're seeing protest community join in at 1 a.m. Like people were about, I was planning to go to sleep and I saw this and I had to come. People who were part of the George Washington University encampments who went to GW. I saw like 8 people from GW. I saw some from American, and they're arriving like after midnight because they saw the call, because in many ways, when you're dealing with the police, it's a numbers game. So these reinforcements and help asked by Howard students come after midnight. And then that crowd, you know, that grows maybe to, you know, I think we're at 50 or 60, and their chants going on, and there's we're not leaving going on. And then if there were talk of disbursement, they were just saying, we don't want to hear that. And then many Howard students were speaking to the police. But it came to a head, I think, at 3:30 in the morning, after a lot of back and forth, and they were ready to move in force in huge numbers. And the feeling that, I heard from Howard students is we just don't have the numbers. I mean, the police were loading up. They were loading up. There were more.
How many police?
Oh, it had to be at least 100. And when you're counting all the cars,
wow.
You know, you're counting all the cars because you have like a, you know, 30 police lined up, and then you have people in the back. You know, it's your typical MPD waste of money, meaning if they just, you know, didn't do anything and went to sleep and didn't steal taxpayers' overtime pay, you know what? It was a very loving space. I mean, it was a very loving space. Like I said, Cupid Shuffle at 10:30 p.m. This and with intentionality, they said, we're going to be loving. We're going to have Black joy here. This is what you heard. And it was small. So, I probably from a police perspective, after what happened last year, you know, there's just a different reaction. I think if this happened last year, before last year, those tents are still up. Yeah.
And so people looked at the police, people looked at their forces, there were no arrests, people disbanded. Is that what I'm supposed to understand?
Yeah, after about a 3-hour struggle and back and forth, and we're not leaving, and we're not going, when it came to an actual head, and they're moving in, they're ready to make arrests, a judgment call, because they told me we're not sure what we're going to do till that moment. This is the Howard students. A judgment call was made based on numbers, based on what it looked like, that, you know what, we're going to pack this last tent up after it was completely, you know, extended. And of course, you always, you know, whatever decisions making, the students are the ones that, you know, are going to face repercussions. But it was very clear to me, the students said, this is not over. You know, what that looks like, is, we don't know. But they said, this is not over.
Wow. From everything you're saying, that sounds very smart tactically by the students.
Yeah.
Because the last thing we need right now is to have a lot of our leading folks dealing with bail and dealing with courts when we're not ready for that full chance at victory.
Yeah.
You know, or even if it's not victory, at the chance of being able to have as many forces as we can. And this certainly sounds more like the start of something than the end of something. Is there a follow-up of any sort that you think people should know about? Or well, anything else, Chuck?
I think there is a follow-up, but I don't know what that is. And I don't know if they know what that is. But I know that they're going to, you know, reconvene. Because I was speaking to many of the individuals at Howard throughout. And I have a history of covering Howard. So it was good that I, from the GW protest, I immediately, last year, I interviewed many Howard students at GW and recognized them immediately. So I was being kept abreast, and they just said, no, this will not end. This will not end. We're going to reconvene. We're going to figure out what our next step is. So stay tuned. And that's sort of that conversation is like close to 4 a.m.
Stay tuned. Was this called by, this is my last question. Was this called by a specific group on campus, a group of groups, or did it feel more like, okay, we need to now form a group because we're all out here?
I think it's more the latter, but what a lot of people missed is that during the GW encampments, which Howard was always present, and all 9 DMV universities were always present, is that Howard was also doing day protests. I covered a few and teach-ins at Howard University, and it was tend to be a teach-in. So when you went to Howard University, hey, WPFW's Jackie Lukman might be there at their request teaching about imperialism. Okay, shout out to Jackie. That might have been one of the things they covered. So it was a lot of political education. It was maybe less of the just you know, chanting this, chanting that, but political education that would go on in Howard. And they would say that because the argument, and it was expressed last night, I'll end on this quote, was that we are not following maybe some of the radical tradition, and which was what we want to do. So here's a quote that I got last night and posted. Quote, Kwame Ture, Amiri Baraka, Zora Neale Hurston, these powerful folks came out of this institution. But this institution hates radical Black people. They suppress and don't want you to know this history because we will come up with stuff just like this. And there was, that's a direct quote. And there was a feeling of this group that the Black radical tradition of some of the people I had just named is suppressed, is not talked about, is put to the side, and we want to uplift that history of Howard. And the feeling was maybe a lot of those individuals that I just mentioned, you know what, are not uplifted, if anything, the opposite.
Downlifted.
There you go.
That, you know, this is so interesting and important, Chuck, because of Howard's place on the firmament of DC schools, of HBCUs, certainly, and the ripple effect they can have. Did this feel like the start of something?
That's a great question. It felt like it at the beginning, certainly, because they were planning to be there, and they were talking about the town halls every day at 6 p.m. We're going to have political education. We're going to invite professors as well. One professor came, I wish I got this name, did come down and was in solidarity and talking to the students, which was not uncommon from previous encampments. But they were saying Save the Africana Studies Department, which was an outgrowth of the 1968 protests that happened at Howard University. So there's a feeling of that connection that created the Africana Studies Department with the current state and status that is happening now. with this anti-DEI. Well, all HBCUs by definition are going to talk about Black advancement, right? It's called historically Black college. And where does that fit in there? So these are the conversations that were being had at the encampment.
And it certainly speaks to some of the, shall we call it in this case, code, like, let's call it white billionaire oligarchical code switching with President Trump in his first term, putting the funding at HBCUs as kind of the heart of his anti-racist agenda.
Yeah.
And that's actually that's not a new thing on the right wing, you know, saying funding HBCUs as a way to do it. It speaks to a lot of their politics in a distorted form in some of the respects. But what's interesting is that there is no anti-racist agenda of any kind in this current administration. There is no Ben Carson in the administration to tokenize. We do care what Black people think about X, Y issue or whatnot. You know, this iteration is just like pure uncut white supremacy across the board. And so what is the place of it, especially when they're going after federal funds for universities like Harvard? I mean, the reason why you go after a Harvard is that it makes a Howard scared, because it's like, whoa, if they can go after Harvard, they're going to go after us. It's a way of cowing people. But one really does wonder what is going to happen once their eyes train on these HBCUs, because they have zero, you know, they make up whatever they want. You know, nothing has to be true. Kilmara Berejo Garcia, you know, is a criminal. You know, they can, although, of course, if even no matter what he was, everybody deserves due process and not to be sent to an El Salvadoran slave labor camp. That I hope goes without saying. But they're going to make up whatever they have to make up. There's no truth. There is no sense of an objective reality. And there's certainly, and this is the number one reason why Kilmar Garcia is still behind bars in El Salvador in horrific gulag conditions. Yeah. The number one reason is that Trump doesn't want the political loss of having to bring him back home. And so because of that, his life gets to be destroyed.
Yeah.
In this process.
And I go ahead.
No. It's just, I was at a demonstration yesterday myself that was about supporting, and you know me, Chuck, I don't go to demonstrations that are about supporting Democratic Party officials. It's just not what I do. It's not how I spend my time. But this time, this was like the first one I've gone on in, gosh, I don't even know when. Maybe it was an anti-death penalty demonstration with Dennis Kucinich in like 2003 or something. But this was really about a send-off of Van Hollen going to El Salvador and showing that we support, because this is why I went. It was like, we support every politician with a pulse taking that short plane ride to El Salvador and just trying to determine whether Kilmar Garcia is even still alive at this point. You know, there's been no contact. And so, you know, support of Van Hollen doing that, of course, you know, what happened, I think, was actually quite predictable. Although it's still very important to show that, like, wow, Donald Trump actually has more solidarity with this Christian Zionist nationalist dictator of El Salvador than he does with a senator from the great state of Maryland.
Right. And there's no confusion. If I didn't say it, it goes without saying. Everybody at Howard and elsewhere knows Trump's a monster. You know, sometimes I don't say that because it's like, okay, we're WPFW. That's understood. Trump is a monster, right? That is clear. And what he's doing is a monstrosity. But the larger question about HBCUs comes into play because, you know, Columbia University has a $15 billion endowment. They're complicit. They could have easily said, forget you, Trump. Easily. It would have been 2.7% of their endowment. Harvard University, who technically rejected Trump, has a $50 billion endowment, the highest of anywhere. And they could do what they want. But in truth is they actually already were complicit in some of Trump's fascist demands. They took on the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism back in January, one of the first schools. So they're already doing fascist things. So it's not as nice as it seems on paper that Harvard, quote unquote, rejected Trump. But then when we bring to HBCUs, we're talking Howard is the only university that has $1 billion. It's $1 billion, not $15 billion. It's $1 billion. And also HBCUs often get a much higher percentage of federal funding, which is the case of Howard. I asked that question a lot. I couldn't get it necessarily pinned down but the federal government is very integrated. And one of those integrations is a recent Department of Defense contract from a couple of years ago. And as one Howard student explained it to me, it's over $100 million, but it's not simply about being in bed with weapons manufacturers like every other university. But what the Department of Defense does when they have these contracts is that they work with the computer engineering department and the computer science department. And I know this because a student I talked to was from that department and said the reason they do that, the Department of Defense could get free labor. It's a labor issue. All those interns, mm-hmm. they work with a professor. That professor works with a bunch of computer science, computer engineering interns to help build the best bomb. His quote, not mine. And that is why the Department of Defense is so integrated with the university. Despite the gazillion dollar budget, they want the free labor of interns.
Wow. The commonality of free labor at home, free labor in a slave labor camp in El Salvador, you know, the Trump call for more manufacturing jobs in the United States, but no saying that that's what made America great, which is garbage, and no call for the unions that actually made those manufacturing jobs something that you could build a family on. So, you know, this idea of attempting to push down American labor is, of course, one of the things that makes this administration, frankly, much more typical than atypical. We talk a great deal about the atypicality, but there's also a tremendous line that has existed through other administrations. So I digress. Let's go to break right now. When we come back, I'm going to talk a little about the intersection of what Harvard is doing and Steve Kerr. I think what Harvard is doing actually has a basis of importance, even if we absolutely should, as Chuck says, note some of the hypocrisies. But I digress. Let's go to a break right now. Station break. We are WPFW 89.3 FM. Support us, as always, WPFWFM.org, because we are trying to change this world one broadcast at a time.
One thing about music, when it hit, you feel no pain. White folks say it controls your brain. I know better than that. That's game, man. We ready for that. Two soldiers head of the pack. Matter of fact, who got the war? And where my army at? Rather attack and not react. Back to beats, it don't reflect on how many records get sold on sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Whether your projects put on hold in the real world. These just people with ideas. They just like me and you when the smoke and cameras disappear again. The real world. It's bigger than all these fake records. Wait, po folks got the millions and my woman. Disrespect it if you check one, two. My word of advice to you is just relax. Just do what you got to do. If that don't work, then kick the fact. If you a fighter, ride a bada, flame ignite a crowd excited, or you wanna just get high and just say it. But then if you a lie, pants on fire, wolf cry, agent with a why, I'm gonna know it when I play it. It's bigger than hip hop.
One of the all-timers. Let's bring it to you, Magic Mike. What were we just listening to? Tell everybody, please.
Hip Hop by Dead Prez.
Oh, just one of the all-timers. Love Dead Prez. Seen them live more than a few times. But let's take it right here. Chuck, you know, one of the things that I've been wrestling with, that I know Etan has been wrestling with, and I'm sure you've been wrestling with as well, is trying to understand how the pro sports world, and I don't think we should separate it from other institutions, has also been silent, compliant in some cases, like with UFC, complicit, United Fighting Champion, Unified Fighting Championship, UFC, mixed martial arts, like have been complicit or compliant with the Trump administration. you know, the White House visits of the Eagles and particularly the Dodgers after the disrespect of Jackie Robinson. It's like we've been looking for things like we saw in the first Trump administration, where there was a steady drumbeat of anti-Trumpism that occurred throughout the sports world. You know, voices of people like Megan Rapinoe, voices of people like Michael Bennett, voices of people throughout the sports world, you know, who were raising real, real political disagreements with what Trump was doing. We have not seen that in the sports world this time around. I think it's governed by fear in some cases. I think it's governed by complicity. In other cases, with the leagues we are talking about, we're in an oligarchical age, and the people who own these franchises are profoundly richer than they were even 8 years ago. Nine, when Trump first came on the scene.
Yeah.
Like the billionaire extraction that has occurred over the last decade has changed a lot of the dynamics. Also, and you know I've argued this a bunch, I think strongly about this, the revenues from the addiction economy of gambling has, we don't talk about this nearly enough, has produced such a revenue stream in the world of sports that it makes the stakes higher. I mean, when I hear announcers talk casually about, you know, with all due respect to him, but Domas Sabonis, and they call him the $50 million man because he makes $50 million a year, it's like, yeah, I have to shake my head a second and be like, wait a minute, what? You know, Sabonis is a fine player, good rebounder, a good passer, with a pretty terrible team in the Kings, as folks might have seen last night against the Mavericks. But 50 mil, I mean, that's the gambling economy. And you cannot tell me that that does not also have a distorting effect on consciousness, when if you're a player who makes on the low end of things, you can say to yourself, whoa, you know, not only am I going to have some money to set up this in the next generation, but I could have money to be like one of those billionaires too. And I can be in that club, and it creates, and then I can do some good as a billionaire, which never happens. So the distorting effect of the revenue streams, I also do think plays a role, but you know what I think, man, I always think there's an ebb and flow to this stuff. And we saw a little bit of flow after the playoffs when somebody who's been outspoken in the past, and you know who I'm talking about, the coach Steve Kerr of the Golden State Warriors, coming off a victory. I have to say that I am very, very happy. Now, I know what you're going to say, because the Harvard connection can make it a little bit difficult, because we know the complicity of Harvard and a lot of these institutions. But Steve Kerr coming out the day that Trump was like, we are freezing your funds because you're not going to bend the knee to us. Steve Kerr, after their victory the other night against the Memphis Grizzlies, wore a Harvard basketball shirt.
That's right.
And said, I believe in academic freedom. I think it's crucial for all of our institutions to be able to handle their own business the way they want to. And they should not be shaken down and told what to teach, what to say by our government. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. And he also said, yes, this is me supporting Harvard. Way to go. Way to stand up to the bully. Now, let me get your thoughts on that, Chuck, because on the one hand, yes, Harvard has been complicit up to a point. But on the other hand, what they did in standing up to Trump on this, on the question of do we have to bend the knee even more to get our money, is they took a very opposite tack of Columbia.
That's right.
And that to me is very important, because it speaks to the outrage as to what Columbia is doing, when Columbia, I think, thought they would get in major favor with everybody in there. You know, and maybe they did get major favor with their big donors, but it's not just about donors. It's also about brand capital. And Columbia very much hurt their brand as a place where kids might actually want to go. Like, applications are down dramatically. And this is Columbia we're talking about. So I'm not saying there wasn't also a self-interest calculus involved with Harvard, but I also think that the stand-up itself and what Kerr is saying is a kind of like an emperor has no clothes kind of a thing. Like, wait a minute, the government is shaking down a private university and telling them what to teach? You know, it's just one of those things. It's like, it's in line with, I don't know if you heard this story, but they're also demanding a settlement from CNN, or saying CNN is going to face continual lawsuits. And part of the terms, I don't think CNN is going to sign this because it's gone public and it's too embarrassing, but one of the terms they sent to CNN was, we want a favorable documentary about either Melania or Don Jr. So they are actually trying to dictate propaganda programming to independent, and of course I put that in quotes, news outlets, just like with law firms, like, well, we want you to actually, you know, defend us in the cases involving closing abortion clinics, you know? Yeah. So it's like compelling people to do pro bono work they probably wouldn't have done otherwise. And they owe $100 million of free legal work to the I mean, it's all a big mafia shakedown.
That's right.
And we've never seen anything like this in our lifetime, where they'll be like, well, we're just going to hold money back from you until we do what you say.
Yes.
It's supposed to be Congress that has the power of that purse money that's been allocated, but they have basically abdicated their power.
Yeah.
But given all of this, Chuck, what do you think about the Harvard stand-up, and what do you think about Steve Kerr using the Harvard stand-up to make this broader point?
So there's a lot there. And so let's start with Steve Kerr. Like, hats off to Steve Kerr. You know, hats off. He is speaking out, you know, some of the intricacies that I've talked about and we'll talk about. He doesn't know about that. Most people don't know about that. So for him to stand up and say that you want, has a Harvard shirt and you want academic freedom, I think that's important. I think, you know, that subject is very important. And I give all the credit to, you know, Steve Kerr. And Steve Kerr, this is, you know, it's not his first rodeo of speaking up. So I feel good about that. The second part about Harvard is they're an outlier. Like, they have a $50 billion endowment. If Trump went to, and they say, Trump says, we're going to freeze your $2.2 billion. Well, you know, that's a lot of money if anyone hears it, unless you're Harvard, right? If you're a Harvard and you have a over $50 billion endowment, okay, it's, you know, 4%. And there is no Harvard. So, you know, Harvard is $50 billion. Yale is $40 billion. You go down the top 10 list, and the majority of them are Ivy Leagues. Columbia University comes in number 8 as $15 billion. But, you know, after you get past a lot of Ivy Leagues and you go down the list, even after you get past the top 25, we're down to $3 billion. Georgetown University in D.C., $3.6 billion. So a lot, in many ways, we're talking about some Ivies, we're talking about a few other schools. George Washington University, it's $2.6 billion at 36. So this is abnormal, right? This is abnormal to have these endowments. So I think that has to be part of the conversation. Harvard can do things. And then I think, and I've learned this and I mentioned it, but I think it's worth reiterating. All love to Steve Kerr, but Harvard has done a bit of capitulation already in the last year. And one of Trump's 9 fascist demands that he made of Columbia and other universities was to adopt the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism. And many of those examples in the IHRA definition is making critique of Israel. Anti-Semitic. And we've mentioned there's an Anti-Semitism Awareness Act in Congress right now. And I believe, and many of others believe, and every ACLU fire and every free speech organization believes that this is the greatest threat to free speech in America. And Harvard has, on their own, in January, already adopted that as Harvard lead and one of the few universities. So you're going to see a cascade of that happening. So, you know, Steve Kerr doesn't know this. Most people don't know this. But when you hang around protesters, they tell you this stuff, because every time I go to protesters and I'm inflated about something I saw on TV, I say, hey, how do you feel about this? Isn't this good news? And they break down the real story for me. So, you know, if I sound like, oh, you know, why are you bursting our bubble, Chuck? Well, it's because the protesters I cover transformed me. And the reason they transform me is they have more knowledge than me. And they know the details that the public doesn't know. And they can tell me, so I can tell WPFW listeners, that, you know what, Harvard is not the bastion of resistance that you think they are. So if people like my knowledge, then they need to give credit to the protesters that I cover, because they're the most knowledgeable people that I've ever been in front of and learned from, because they have to be, because the protesters are the ones who are facing the oppression, and they have to know the details, every little detail, because if they're wrong, it may affect them. Whereas that may not be the case for all of us talking. So I'm happy, but I can't let that IHRA definition thing go, because that is one of the most fascist things that they did on their own.
Wow. Yeah. No. That has proven to be exactly what we said it would be from the beginning. And while I'm shocked at the ferocity with which they're using the shibboleth of anti-Semitism to crack down on anti-Zionism, I am not shocked that it's happening, period.
Yeah.
I really do think it took a hypocrite. Like, you have to be a brazen hypocrite to be as anti-Semitic as Donald Trump and say you're taking over campuses and ruining civil rights and sending people to El Salvador and gulags and locking people away 1,000 miles away from their families and even their 8-month pregnant spouses, that you're doing all of this in the name of fighting anti-Semitism. I mean, it really did take a huckster as Donald Trump to do something like this. Enraging all around.
Yeah.
Enraging the attack on Maryland that's taking place right now as well. And I mean the state of Maryland.
Yeah.
But let's take it away from that for a second.
Sure.
I do think it's important for us to acknowledge Steve Kerr's history on this question.
Absolutely.
Which is, and I know you're very familiar with this, Chuck, and I know some of our listeners are familiar with this, Chuck, but even if you are not familiar with this, it is important to know that it's no coincidence to me that Steve Kerr is able to criticize this institution, because Steve Kerr was not raised to be a Zionist.
Right.
You know, that is not a small factor in all of this, because that is handcuffing people who even know what they see is wrong, but fear being called anti-Semitic, not because they fear like they're going to be shamed in their communities or anything like that. They are fearful of being called anti-Semitic, because now we know this is like McCarthyite times. Now we know what that can mean for you.
Yeah.
You know, and it's ugly. And Steve Kerr, for people who may know, spent part of his childhood in Beirut, in Lebanon. His father, Dr. Malcolm Kerr, is considered one of the great writers about Arab nationalism, about anti-Zionist resistance. I mean, there is a rich canon that comes from Malcolm Kerr. Malcolm Kerr was killed in Beirut by extremists on the campus of American University, where he was the president. And Steve Kerr has taken his father's lessons in life forward to say that, you know, this is not something that I accept in terms of the attacks on free speech. He comes from a family of academics, his mother as well. And so I think him speaking out is not only appropriate, it's so necessary. And I know the support of Harvard makes it very difficult, but the fact that he was pulling it off the news cycle.
Oh, yeah.
Makes it important, because
it is very important.
It got the attention of people.
It is very important. Yeah.
In a way that we want to see. So I digress. We got to go free Kilmar Abrejo Garcia. We can't say that as many times enough on this show. He's from Temple Hills, Maryland, for those who don't know, in Prince George's County in the DMV. We are not going to rest until this man is home. But, you know, like I said at the start of the show, Chuck, this is my favorite time of year, NBA playoffs. We only have a little bit of time left. So what I'm going to do is ask you whether or not you buck from 2 points of conventional wisdom. And then we're going to go from there.
But you can you do one thing? Can Please. You make your case for the Clippers that you had made privately?
Yes. I do think the Clippers are going to go from the Western Conference to the finals. I predict they're going to play the Cleveland Cavaliers. I'm not sure who's going to win yet because the LA Clippers, since Kawhi Leonard has come back in full health for the first time in years. Of course, the question is, will he stay healthy? But I think he can based on the minutes load he's been playing recently and the way his body looks. And if he does, they are, to me, the best team in the Western Conference. They're deep. James Harden is playing some of the best ball of his career when he's been in that secondary role. Let's call it secondary James Harden. I like that because it puts less pressure on him come playoff time, while Kawhi Leonard lives for that pressure, so they're a great balance. Love Ivica Zubats, their center, who's just, he's the most improved player in the NBA. The most
Killing it.
Maybe the most improved player that I've seen over the last two decades, in terms of just like the hard work and getting better. And I mean, they run offense through him sometimes and he finds shooters. It's amazing to see.
12.6 rebounds a game.
Not only that, 2 fouls a game.
Yeah.
I mean, for a guy who plays that big and protects the rim to not be somebody who fouls, I mean, that's an art in and of itself. So that's my call on the Clippers. But here's my question for you. We only got a little time left. Can any Oklahoma City, they win 68 games. They set an NBA record for point differential. What is the team that you think can most likely unseat OKC on their quest to the finals? Or do you think it's a silly question because they're too big a favorite?
I mean, it's not a silly question. This is the NBA. But if you're asking me, do I think OKC will win the championship? I do. I do think they'll win the championship. They have so many good three-point shooters, as well as surrounding. They sort of, built their team to the metrics of the analytics of the three-point shot in many ways. They obviously have, a great player, SGA. And, in my opinion, the second best player after Joker this year. That's another conversation. So they have the ingredients. Who could beat them? My Knicks, of course. I would love for my Knicks to go far, but of course the Knicks aren't the favorite. But I think in the NBA, I think if you have a LeBron and Luke, I don't think they're a favorite, but I think they have a shot. I think if you're the Clippers, for the reasons that you'd mentioned, I think they have a shot. I don't think this is a gimme or anything like that. So I think a number of teams have a shot to win. But do I think OKC will win? I do.
Yeah, okay. Well, then let's get to the second question. We have just enough time for it. Everybody and their best friend's mama says the Eastern Conference Finals are Cavs versus Boston, and everybody else is an afterthought, including our New York Knicks, who are 0-8 against those two teams this year. Yikes. Does any team, do you think, have at least a legitimate shot at breaking that Cavs-Celts inevitability?
I'm despite the 0-8, it doesn't go statistically. They have a shot. And the reason I say that, and I think anytime you have like a Giannis, you have a shot, right? You know, when you have for the Bucks, you have someone like that who could just go nuts. You have a shot, right? With the Knicks, the thing about the Knicks is they're good at defense, right? They're good at defense, and defense generally has a stronger role in the playoffs. Now, the problem with also the Knicks, so I see it sometimes them being could be elevated. The problem with the Knicks, and we've discussed this many times, is Coach Tibbs, runs his players into the ground. If you go in the top 20 players who have averaged the most minutes, all five Knicks are in that top 20. All five starters are in that top 20. The couple are in the top five, Josh Hart and Bridges. I think three of the top five or something like that. So this is Tibbs during the year. And we know from history, he shortens his rotation. Like, he wouldn't take Josh Hart off the floor last year until he got injured. He had some games where in overtime, he played 52 minutes. I mean, it was just, wild. So Tibbs runs his players into the ground, and I'm afraid he's going to probably do the same thing again. And I don't like that he does that. So that's the knock against the Knicks, but I think they have a chance. I think Giannis has a chance.
Well, but that's the thing that, oh, Giannis, damn. I don't know if they're getting out of the first round against the Pacers, but I digress.
They may not, but
I digress. Tyrese Halliburton finding the fountain of youth. I've never anybody so young has had to find the fountain of youth. Tyrese Halliburton has. Yo, Chuck, man, thanks for the Howard reporting, man. That was really special. You always make our show special. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir. And much love to the Howard students.
Much love to the Howard students. Much love to the family of Kilmar Abrejo Garcia. Yo, Temple Hills, Maryland, everybody. We got to keep up the fight. This is a local fight, a national fight, and an international fight. But it all starts here in the DMV. So for everybody out there listening, please stay frosty. We are out of here. Peace. But soon you start to suffer. But you wanna get rougher. When you start to stutter, that's when you had enough. Fighting it'll make you choke. You can't provoke. You can't cope. You should have broke because I ain't no joke.
Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at wpfwfm.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at wpfwfm.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hi, this is Jim Byers, host of the Latin Flavor Classic Edition. For nearly 5 decades, support from listeners like you has kept WPFW's wheels rolling. In fact, the single largest category of donations comes from those who donate an unused car to the station. That's right, running or not. Even a car sitting idle that needs thousands of dollars in repairs can do wonders for WPFW. If you can't drive it, donate it. WPFW will get the proceeds, and you'll get a tax break. Go to WPFWFM.org or call 1-866-WPFW-CAR. That's 1-866-973-9227 for more information. Help WPFW continue building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hello, I'm Dave Zirin, host of WPFW's The Collision, with an editorial. Mahmoud Khalil, a student at Columbia University and a U.S. permanent resident, has been illegally detained by ICE for organizing against the U.S.-supported genocide in Palestine. In detaining Khalil, the Trump administration, the State Department, and the Department of Homeland Security have made clear that they are more than willing to violate constitutionally protected rights to punish those who speak out against them and Israel's war on the people of Gaza. This is a deeply alarming development. It is a march towards authoritarianism. It is a blatant encroachment on our democracy, and it places all of us in peril, especially members of the most vulnerable and marginalized communities in our country. In the words of Angela Davis, if they come for me in the morning, they will come for you at night. Standing together as people of conscience and demanding Mahmoud Khalil's freedom, it is a stand against fascism, and it is a stand for our collective right to free speech and protest. I'm Dave Zirin. This has been a WPFW editorial.
I'm Dennis Williams with the WPFW editorial. Kilmar Abrego Garcia, an apprentice sheet metal worker raising 3 children with his wife in Prince George's County, has been kidnapped by the United States government. On March 12th, Abrego Garcia was pulled over by ICE agents accused of being a member of the Salvadoran gang MS-13 and then transported to a terrorist confinement center in his native El Salvador. In fact, Abrego Garcia had fled his homeland at 16 because of threats from local gangs, and a U.S. immigration judge in 2019 granted him protection from being deported because he would face persecution if he ever returned. The Justice Department admitted that his removal was an administrative error, and the U.S. Supreme Court ordered the government to facilitate the return of Abrego Garcia, who has never been charged with a crime or found to have any gang affiliation. President Trump shrugged and said that it was up to El Salvador. Salvadoran dictator Nayib Bukele, appearing in the Oval Office, scoffed that the idea of releasing him was, quote, preposterous, while Trump and top advisors smiled approvingly. This is an appalling